Star Trek Discovery episode number 3 is over, but we're just getting started here on the Star Trek post-show recap. And now here are the two guys who are just a little bummed out to hear that snoring has not been cured in the 23rd century. I am Rob Cisgrino, and here with me today to talk about Context is for Kings is John Reed. John, how are you?
I'm great, Rob. I'm so happy that we finally get to find out what this Star Trek show actually is. Just disappointed that Tribbles didn't play a larger role in this episode.
Yes, it was like Chekhov's Tribble. And no, I'm not talking about Pavel Chekhov, but we did have a Tribble sitting there on the desk the entire episode, and nobody said anything about it.
No, never addressed. They didn't multiply, nothing.
I'm just glad that we finally have people. Captain Lorca has followed Bob Barker's adage, and have your Tribble spayed or neutered. That is the only humane thing to do with a Tribble.
Tribble prequels. You know, it seems as if they should have known how to deal with them later on in the series back in the 60s. If Lorca's handling it fine, you think Kirk could have figured it out?
We don't need to go back into the plot of Trouble with Tribbles, but he seems to have his finger on the pulse with all these biological experiments, that maybe he had one that was sterile and then that was fine to keep around. But the problem is that these other Tribbles are just like multiplying like crazy. Maybe he did something. Maybe the spores ended up knocking this one out from being able to reproduce.
Maybe he actually created Tribbles and then the mad scientist thing got away from him. Maybe that's what's going on.
So you think that Star Trek Discovery is going to be a whole backstory to explain why Tribbles reproduce so much?
I guess that's as good of a reason to have this show around as any.
Yeah. It's going to make some sense at the end of the first season of Star Trek Discovery. We'll have all of our answers. Anyway, so John is here with us. Of course, John is a co-host on the Nerdrotic podcast. John, what kind of stuff do you talk about on Nerdrotic?
Oh, we talk about all the geek news. The Gifted is coming up. Anything that's superhero or comic book related that's on TV or in movies, we try to touch on at some point. You can head over to YouTube and check that out if you want.
Okay, so John, how have you been enjoying Star Trek Discovery so far?
I'm probably higher on Star Trek Discovery than most. I mean, at best, I'm like a 50% Trekkie, right? Like, I enjoyed The Next Generation. I liked a lot of the movies. So, but I'm not one of these people who is like really honed in on like what makes great Star Trek. So I'm just kind of looking for entertainment value here. And it's delivering to a pretty high degree in that respect. I can understand why the format isn't exactly what the format of a Star Trek show should be. So I kind of understand like some of the negativity around it, but I'm enjoying it on a visceral level for sure.
Yeah, this was my favorite episode so far. Yes. Of the three of Star Trek Discovery. And this to me felt a little bit more like what the show was supposed to be. And maybe it had to do with now us finally getting to the Discovery. Also, I think it didn't hurt that we didn't spend that much time with the Klingons in this episode. We mostly spent our time figuring out what was going on the Discovery. So overall, of the three episodes, I think this one was the best. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, I liked the second episode a lot. I thought that it set up a lot of the stuff that I like about shows like Battlestar Galactica. And, the looming threat of the Klingons, I think, was an interesting way to start off the series. And I liked that there was a big time jump. I really love time jumps in these types of shows, to like yada yada over like the subjugation part and get to like the cool stuff where they're starting to fight back. So, I liked the second episode to some degree, but this is definitely the best of the three so far. Yeah, I totally agree.
All right. So if you want to make sure you don't miss any more of our Star Trek post-show recaps, make sure you subscribe to the podcast. Go to postshowrecap.com/Star Trek. We always appreciate your feedback and your star ratings here with getting this podcast off the ground. postshowrecap.com/Star Trek. So a lot of questions opened up in this episode in terms of the Discovery and its mission. And to me, you know, I'm really wondering what is going on with this spore technology that they seem to be working on. You know, it was a big mystery the whole episode. By the end of the episode, Captain Lorca ends up sort of pulling back the curtain on what they're trying to do. And it appears to be some sort of a system to unlocking, I don't know if wormholes is the right sort of terminology to use, but it seems like that you would be able to travel from, you know, one quadrant of the galaxy to another. Now, the issue here for me is that we're talking about a technology that obviously does not exist in the time of Star Trek, the original series, Star Trek, the Next Generation, or any of the series to come, yet we have seen this show play with the idea of what technology is canon and what technology is not. So, John, were you interested in the spore travel technology?
First of all, it's very, very cool. It's like, you know, cosmic mushrooms, but you actually can teleporting cosmic mushrooms, which, you know, congrats on coming up with that sort of a plot device.
Yeah, I think you have to take mushrooms to come up with the idea for this.
Yeah, exactly. And I couldn't tell if it's just like a mind trip where you can like see to other places or times, or if they're actually traveling there for like a split second and then traveling back. Because Lorca's pitching this as like some sort of a space fuel or something, right?
So yeah.
I don't know. I don't think we're supposed to quite know what like Captain Lorca is orchestrating.
Well, I got the sense that it was a very literal thing that was going to unlock these passages through space that was going to allow them to travel in an instant from one place to another. Not just, he sort of said, and you're back and it was just a dream. Like, I think he was being a little figurative there in how he was describing it. But since he's talking about something that can literally help them win the war, I felt like it was something that was going to help them move from place to place.
So he's basically invented biological teleportation to anywhere that they can imagine going, which seems like super powered. I'm guessing that that's got to have some negative ramifications, right? I mean, they're ingesting these spores. You've got to think that there's something that's going to happen because of that. Or else we'd see this technology, you know, in the future, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I don't know if it was necessarily that they're teleporting. I think that what they're trying to say is that it is opening up these passages where they're talking about sort of like the muscles and veins that hold space and time together, where you are able to travel much like a blood cell in your body may travel very quickly from one part of your body to another. That's sort of like what they're unlocking in the universe with the help of these spores.
So like the turtles in Finding Nemo, essentially.
Yes.
Like these superhighways.
Right. You're able to get into some sort of like the interstellar superhighway to get very quickly from one place to the next. And that is what they're working on to ultimately beat the Klingons in this war. We see Michael Burnham being taken from her transport to a penal colony. And then ultimately she gets pulled into working on the Discovery. John, now that we know everything that we know in this episode, did Captain Lorca sabotage the prison convoy? And ultimately, is he responsible for the death of the shuttlecraft pilot?
Yes. Yes, he did. I think Lorca is doing a lot of really crazy stuff, because we also find out that there's more of the crew that Michael was on her last ship with. And it seems like he's orchestrating all of this stuff.
Orchestrating.
So he's orchestrating a lot of shady things, and it's resulting in a lot of death and destruction. So yes, he totally just demolished that pilot to get Michael onto his ship.
Yeah. Is Captain Lorca the villain of the series? Is he ultimately a good guy or a bad guy?
So I think it would be really interesting if he were the good guy of the series. I just don't see them going that direction. I mean, what about you, Rob? Do you think that they're going to do a twist where he's like this flawed hero, or is he just a crazy mad scientist captain dude?
Well, I think it would be interesting to have a captain who's like a series regular, who's sort of like this unsavory character who is probably maybe more, what would you say, John? What's the right term? Chaotic evil?
definitely chaotic evil. I'll have to go back to my D&D handbook and
is
make sure
that's correct.
Is
there lawful evil that he's sort of like, you know, working for Starfleet, but he is willing to compromise his integrity?
I don't think you can be lawful evil, but that's what I think would be the interesting character here. I think we need to break those rules and have him be lawful evil. I think that the DM needs to be okay with that happening on this show.
Yeah. We'll see if they're okay with that. Because we have Michael Burnham, who's sort of been like painted as like this figure. Oh, the mutineer, the terrible person, Michael Burnham. But she's really not. She's not a bad person. And do you feel like that the events of the mutiny have been really blown out of proportion here over these last 6 months?
I think they've been underblown out of proportion. I think that she really made some stupid decisions that resulted into the death of everyone around her. And I think that everyone should be more worried about having that decision making around them.
But what's the part that really made everybody upset? Is it that she, A, went out in the spacesuit to go investigate the Klingon artifact? Was it B, when she ended up doing the Vulcan nerve pinch to Captain Georgiou and ended up trying to commandeer the ship? Was it C, when she then went on the Klingon ship with Captain Georgiou and then ended up killing the person who was like the new Klingon leader? Was it all of the above?
Yeah, I think if I were to rank those, it would be mostly B, right? Like, I think it would be mostly not trusting your captain and trying to assert your will over a hierarchy in a very tense and difficult situation. Even if you're right, what you're doing is wrong and it's going to jeopardize everyone around you. And the rules exist for a reason. And I think Star Trek has always kind of played with that, but she's the first one to really, maybe not the first, but we actually see what happens when she does what she does, right? Like, we see everything just kind of just gets destroyed around her. So I think like Lorca is looking for somebody to be like that, to like stand up for what she thinks. If she thinks she knows the right answer, he wants somebody like that. But Lorca's a little crazy. And so, you know, I would be worried if I were anyone else to have somebody that is difficult to trust around me in wartime.
Okay, now that being said, okay, so that was the most heinous of her actions when she knocked the captain out and tried to commandeer the ship. Okay,
pretty
I
bad.
Get that. Yeah. Yet, very quickly after that, she was taken off the bridge and brought to the brig. I don't believe that any of the actions that she did in that time when she commandeered the ship actually manifested themselves. Like, they did not attack the Klingon ship during that time. So why is she held accountable for 8,100 people dying if nothing happened at the point where she was the mutineer on the ship?
It's an interesting debate, right? But I think it's because you know what happened because of her actions and you don't know what the alternate future or history would have been there, right? So you don't know if she didn't do what she did, if the Captain Georgiou would have gotten them, I can't ever say that name, got them, would have been able to get them out of that situation. So, you know, I think it's because she created the chaos in that moment that led to the delay in between the discovery of the Klingons and the ultimate annihilation of her crew and ship, right? So I think it's just because you don't know what the alternative would have been that she gets blamed for this. But it may have ended up exactly the same, but it may have not.
Because she has now become infamous. Everybody in the galaxy knows Michael Burnham, the mutineer, the only person to ever mutiny against Starfleet. At the time of this episode, I mean, Starfleet is closing in on like maybe 100 years or so of being in business. Nobody ever mutinied against Starfleet ever?
Apparently not, because not only did everyone in the Star Trek universe know that she was a mutineer, apparently everyone in the Expanse universe knows the same thing, because all three of the people on that prison boat were actors that were in the Expanse as well.
Yes.
So we're crossing over. It seems like her infamy knows no bounds, not even network television.
Yeah. And so the one person ever who mutinied against yes. Starfleet, I think that she's become a bit of a scapegoat here. I think that they're just trying to pin everything on Michael Burnham.
Hey, you and Lorca, you know, are in the same boat, right? Like, she could be your greatest weapon. She knows these Klingons inside and out. She had the right decision. And, you know, and it, if the captain had just listened to her, it might be a different scenario as far as he's concerned. So, yeah, maybe it is all blown out of proportion. But I want to be able to trust the people around me. And I don't know if I can, you know, even Saru's like, I like you, but I can't trust you.
John, do you think that that is sort of like a bargaining chip with the Klingons that we have Starfleet coming in? They're like, oh, we didn't know anything about this. It was all Michael Burnham. That was the mutineer. She did this. She didn't. We didn't want a war. It was her fault. She was acting rogue.
It's brilliant, right? Like they can just blame it all on her, and then negotiations start. No, I think that they're screwed no matter what in that case. But yeah, sure. That's a good opening gambit, right? Like she caused all of this. If she weren't here, we'd all be friends.
Yeah,
I think the Klingons will buy that.
Why not? So I was sort of confused this whole episode of, okay, she's a mutineer. Why are they bending over backwards to bring her on board as this person who is like this persona non grata in Starfleet and in the Federation and is a mutineer? But we get a little more clarity on that towards the end of the episode where Captain Lorca asks her to stay on board and she refuses, basically citing, OK, I know what you're trying to do here. And so I think that they're looking for a patsy to ultimately, use this weapon again. Again, they're trying to throw Michael Burnham under the bus or under the shuttlecraft here, proverbially. And they're trying to have her maybe be the point person in using some sort of a weapon against the Klingons.
So you're saying that she's the face of this dangerous operation, so if anything goes wrong, they can just blame her?
Right. So when they use this sort of genetic weapon on the Klingons, and I wonder if there could be sort of like a backdoor set up to, we all, I don't want to say we all, but I complained about what the Klingons look like. I know I was not alone in that criticism of this show, but could this genetic weapon then alter the appearance of the Klingons to make them look like what they will look like in, I mean, it's a long way to go for this. And
you should be writing the show, Rob. I don't know if they have any of these, like, I don't think they care.
No,
one way or the
probably
other.
Not. But there's a little bit of precedent where they talked about there's some sort of a genetic mutation that happened, which ultimately changed the appearance of the Klingons somewhere along the way. This would be a long way to go to try to explain that. But I guess there is that possibility that this sort of genetic mutation ends up altering the appearance of the Klingons.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how much they want to go about retconning, right? Like what they've, like, or trying to tie in what they've done in other series into this. And it seems like they want to throw Easter eggs at us, but they don't really want to get too involved on the technology and the look of the aliens and all of that stuff. So I don't know. I think you're right. I think that that would be really interesting. And I think that that would be the best ending for Lost, but I don't think that that's where this show is really heading. Yeah. It doesn't seem like they care too much about, it seems like they're trying to make more Trek fans and maybe at the expense of some of them that actually know these backstories. I don't know if the writers are even aware of some of this stuff at this point.
Okay, well, let's talk about what's going on the Discovery. And so they bring Michael Burnham off. And first off, can you explain when they bring Michael Burnham to the mess hall, why does a fight break out? What's going on here? Like, are the other prisoners want to fight Michael Burnham?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of pointless. I think that the other prisoners were trying to show, like, hey, we're not, like, everyone hates you, so now we have all these people behind us, and we can just, we don't like you, we're going to take you out. I think it was something of that nature, like, hey, don't hate us, we're taking out this mutineer for you, but it didn't really go as planned. Also, I think it was just a way to have kind of like a prison food scene, fight scene play out on the ship. But yeah, I mean, I think that you could probably make it some sort of a political gambit if you wanted.
No, I don't want to. John, why does Michael Burnham, Mutineer Michael Burnham, why does Mutineer Michael have a different jumpsuit than the other prisoners? A prison jumpsuit which includes a Starfleet badge.
I was wondering the same thing. She must be like a fashion icon to everybody, that they have to make sure that she looks as good as possible at all times. Also, the color, you know, it was yellow, right? Like everyone else was in browns and grays, right. And she was, yeah, and it was a very fashionable jumper. I was wondering exactly the same thing. Maybe it's because Starfleet criminals, like she was being transferred to like a Starfleet jail, and they were just
Starfleet
going to, like,
jail.
I don't know. Like, maybe she was going to a different, you know, she was being transferred, right? So maybe she's going to a different place than everyone else.
So I get that the other people probably were not Starfleet officers that were being on the prison convoy, but at the point that you become a prisoner, why do you get a Starfleet jail uniform?
So that when you show up on the Discovery, you look like you're part of Starfleet, right?
I guess so. And then she had to stay in her Starfleet jail uniform the whole episode.
My guess is she just really likes yellow jumpsuits.
Yeah.
It was snazzy. It was a good, if I go to prison, I want to wear something of that nature.
Okay. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, it was a, mustard onesie.
Yes. It was, you know, the snuggy version of a prison uniform.
I guess so. All right. So we have some reunions on board the Discovery, and Michael Burnham is reunited with the recently promoted. And I said they should promote this guy because he was the one person at the Binary Star that was like, let's get the hell out of here. I was happy to see Saru is back.
So Saru's the first officer, right? But isn't Michael gonna be the first? Didn't basically at the end of this Lorca offer Michael Saru's job? Like, is this they seem to be okay with each other. I think this whole promotion thing is going to get in the way of this friendship.
Boy, that's interesting, because she was the first officer on board the Shenzhou. She was the first officer. Now, Saru is the first officer here. So I wonder if they're going to get in the way of each other. We saw that he was watching when the shuttlecraft ended up going into warp at the end of the episode. I'm not sure why there was an announcement of, like, shuttlecraft now headed back to penal colony. But we saw that he was, like, drinking his salty water, and
very salty.
Like, what was coming out of the? He had like tentacles coming out of his head.
Yeah, he had like little fins, like gills come out of the back.
What did that mean?
Head.
He's happy.
I was going to ask you the same thing. Was he was he sad that she was gone because they were finally reconnecting on an emotional level, or was he like really happy because he doesn't have any competition for the judge? Or maybe like he's in love with her and that was his way of showing that? I have no clue.
Boy, that would be something if that was the direction Star Trek Discovery went, with some sort of a showmance between Michael Burnham and Saru.
A Michael Saru romantic comedy? Yeah. Is that where we're going with this?
Yes, that's their shipping name, Michael Saru.
Michael Saru, it's the Jim and Pam of the Star Trek Discovery.
Sure, let's go with that for the Michael Saru relationship.
Michael Saru relationship, yes.
Yeah. So Michael Burnham finally got to meet up with Captain Lorca. What's going on with Captain Lorca's eyes? He says he wants to keep it dark because his vision is going.
No, he's the Beyonder from Marvel Comics. He just has cosmic eyes, and he hides them from people because it shows his true evil. I think that's where they're going with this. Well, or he's just crazy.
He's dark and mysterious, that's for sure. And he wants to keep the lights down low and give people fortune cookies. John, did you get the symbolism of fortune cookies here in this episode? Why are they so important to Captain Lorca?
Well, Captain Lorca believes in destiny, and I believe these cookies show people their destiny. So I think it's Chekhov's fortune cookie. You're like, what's her fortune going to be? Good or evil?
He talked about how they were from a family business, that Captain Lorca's family was in the fortune cookie business.
Strange, right? Like, I guess, you know, Starfleet is based in San Francisco, and there's lots of really good Chinese food in San Francisco. So maybe there's some sort of tie to that. They're trying to bring it all circle.
Thai food? Yeah.
Thai food, yeah.
So does the fortune cookie get an update in the next 300 years?
Yeah, they actually write between the sheets at the end of every one, so you don't have to actually add it in yourself.
That's perfect. Yeah. That's perfect. Yeah. You would think that, I mean, we have Cadet Tilly is so excited to see a book. I wonder if there's paper in the fortune cookie.
No books, but lots of fortune cookies. It's a very strange thing that happened in between when books went away and fortune cookies became popular.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, it's like it's the Twitter phenomenon, right? Like it's a book in less than 280 characters.
Yes. Okay. That, who knows how many characters that Twitter has by the 22nd century?
You can basically write a book.
Actually, on Twitter, 23rd century. I'm sorry. Yeah. Probably has so many characters that you could have all of Alice in Wonderland in one tweet.
Exactly. Lewis Carroll all over the place.
Yeah. So we end up seeing Michael Burnham. She gets sent to the quarters, and Michael Burnham has to go to like her shift and then is confined to her quarters. But not really. She also can just leave the quarters. Like you would think it would be the kind of thing where she would like the door would not open when she wanted it to because she was being confined to her quarters. But it wasn't like she was locked in there.
No. And not only that, she can harvest drool from her roommate, which they gave her randomly, and use that drool to get into the restricted area that shows her exactly what Captain Lorca's plans are.
Yes.
So, you know, seemed like a gap in security. I don't know what the security woman was doing other than calling people human trash. She wasn't doing a very good job of making sure things were safe.
Yeah. Well, we find out at the end of the episode that maybe Captain Lorca wanted her to see what was going on the ship. Yeah, I did have an issue with that. But I loved the roommate of Michael Byrne. Now, again, why on earth why in any planet in the Federation would you have this person who is a mutineer? Why would you give them a roommate? You have this dangerous loose cannon person, and we're going to put them in a room with one of our Starfleet cadets.
Not only one of your Starfleet cadets, but one of your most naive, susceptible Starfleet cadets.
And you get the sense that somebody went out of their way to say, oh, this will really teach Michael Burnham a lesson. We'll put Michael Burnham in the room with Cadet Tilly. That'll really show Michael Burnham what you get for being a mutineer.
Right, because her... She snores. She snores real loud.
Yeah.
And so she can't have any other roommate except for, you know, convicted mutineers.
Right.
Yeah.
What is this? Like some sort of a summer camp that this is how you would punish somebody? Like, okay, Michael Burnham's really been out of line in the mess hall. So let's put her in the room with the bedwetter.
It's the have-not room of Star Trek Discovery.
Right. Yeah. With Cadet Tilly, who is great. I do love Cadet Tilly as a character. Maybe my favorite new character of the series.
She's good. I still like Sarah. I felt like she had that swing from like naive to like really mean to like really apologetic very quickly in this episode. But the actress, Mary Wiseman, playing Cadet Tilly, she's fantastic as this kind of like, she wants everyone to like her, but she's also extremely ambitious and she's trying to come to terms with those two things. And I can't wait to see what happens with that character for sure.
Right. Cause just about everybody we meet in the Star Trek universe is, you know, pretty exceptional, like very few character flaws along the way. Like if anything, they have like character flaws, like they're too brave or stuff like that, where it's very fun to have a character who has these insecurities that the character of Barkley on The Next Generation was somebody who had a lot of issues and became like a popular character because he sort of had all these outward insecurities. So I do like that we have Tilly in the mix like that. Although then, but when she's on the away mission, you know, I did find that to be a little implausible of that they allowed the mutineer Michael Burnham to, you know, pick her roommate to go on this mission.
Agreed. It seemed like a very random group that they threw together for this away mission, kind of like the last away mission that we saw her previous captain get murdered during. And also, it's an interesting character that Cadet Tilly is kind of a nice, happy character on a Star Trek show with a lot of really dark, kind of twisted people. Like this is kind of like the bizarro universe for Star Trek, right? Like everyone kind of has an agenda and everyone's a little bit dark and gloomy. And then, you know, it's nice to see Tilly very, very positive about things, upbeat. I like that. I think it's going to be necessary to brighten up some of these darker episodes of Star Trek.
Meanwhile, when Michael Burnham is in the room with Cadet Tilly, we have, for the first time, we see a black alert. Do you understand, John, what black alert is?
I have no clue. Have we ever seen that before on Star Trek? Or have you, Rob?
No. No, we have not. I am on Twitter right now trying to look up hashtag black alert, and I am learning a lot of things that have nothing to do with Star Trek.
Yes, what kind of things have you learned on Twitter about black alerts?
You know,
Rob?
I'd rather not boldly go where none of my podcasts have gone before, John.
Very good choice.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, if it were Star Wars, it would make more sense, like a Darth Vader, you know, Vader's here, black alert. But yeah, it was strange. Usually red is the color of choice for this sort of thing.
Right. But I don't even understand, like, Cadet Tilly knows what black alert means, but she won't say anything to Michael Burnham. How big of a secret can it be if Cadet Tilly knows what's going on? I don't even understand what even happened. Like water, like there was like some condensation of like, did some of the spores get out? What was the black alert?
I think the black alert is the black alert, I think, refers to that. It's like a dark project, right? Like it's a classified project. So the alert is about this classified project, which are the spores. And I think that the condensation is some sort of weird side effect to whatever they're doing experimenting on the plants in these spores. So I think the black alert just signifies, hey, if you don't have clearance, something bad is happening, but you can't ask about it.
Okay, so Michael Burnham still does not know what's going on. We see Michael Burnham eventually go to her shift in engineering, and we get to meet the ship's chief engineer for the first time, and that is Lieutenant Stamets. Now, interesting about Lieutenant Stamets that I was reading. I'm not sure. I believe it was Entertainment Weekly. They referred to Lieutenant Stamets. They outed him as the first openly gay character in the Star Trek universe.
It seemed like that's what they were pointing toward with the portrayal of the character. But then he was also kind of a jerk.
yeah.
So it was an interesting choice to like show that you have this like out character serving with Starfleet. And then he's just kind of a jerk to everyone that he comes into contact with.
Yeah.
Strange decisions.
Yeah. Well, you know, I do like this in terms of that. What one of the things we're noticing here in Star Trek Discovery is something that maybe the other Star Treks did not feature prominently. I think we do have flawed characters in, you know, serving in Starfleet. And we got to see a lot of different emotions from Stamets in this episode. And, you know, he was very condescending to Michael Burnham. But then you also got like sort of the, you know, emotional baggage of why he is feeling that way, that he blames her for, you know, all these people dying, and then also his research being used as a weapon.
Yes, and he's kind of angry at the world right now. He just wanted to go out there and be a scientist, and war had to come along and ruin everything. The big question, Rob, is this what do you want your Star Trek characters to all be very like flawed, like in this show? Because I think that that's the biggest weakness. Like, I love the action, and I love the show looks really good. It's fun. The characters are interesting. The plot is dynamic. There's this looming threat. I like all this stuff going on, but I just don't know if I love the fact that all of these characters are like Game of Thronesified, right? How do you feel about that?
No, I think that that's fun. I mean, I feel like that in the Gene Roddenberry universe, I think that what he really wanted Star Trek to be was everybody on the Enterprise worked perfectly together. There was no sort of like dissension in the ranks, and it was, you know, a united front against these like external antagonists that were in every single episode. And Starfleet, you know, was sort of like a well-oiled machine. You know, Kirk would like argue with like the admirals and things like that, but everybody on the ship was getting along particularly well. But I do like that. I feel like it's a lot more realistic that you would have all sorts of different people in your workplace that you may not get along with or see eye to eye with on all these different issues.
That's true. I mean, I think it will allow your conversation with David Bloomberg was very interesting about how you like when Star Trek holds the mirror up to humanity. And I think that the dynamic characters that they've kind of given us this episode specifically will allow the show to do that in a serialized fashion. My worry is that Star Trek works best, I think, when it has a kind of a beginning, like a mission, like Starlog, you know, and then it does the mission. And then over one or two episodes, you get kind of the completion of this mission. It's less about the characters and more about the journey with Star Trek. So I'm just kind of worried they're getting a little far away from the mission statement. But that, I guess that's my thing with it more than anything.
The mission statement of the series?
Yeah, of this Star Trek Discovery series is just changed so dramatically from what it, you know, what Star Trek was for pretty much every show before this.
I do think that maybe that's sort of part of the long-term serialized storytelling, where I do think that if every single episode of Star Trek, that's just sort of like an episodic adventure, is its own little, like, you know, 42-minute play that sort of like has its own theme and like a beginning, middle, and end, where it feels like that Discovery is going to be, you know, different chapters of a book. Hopefully the book has some of the things that we've come to love about Star Trek as a total like work of a season, as opposed to, you know, I don't know if like to, like this episode tonight, where it wasn't necessarily its own self-contained story with a message. And if it was, it was lost on me.
Right. For sure. But we got Tribbles. So I guess that's the, you know, that's what they're going to offer instead. But no, I see what you're saying. I was just curious because I love the discussion you had with David about it. And I've just been feeling similarly that I kind of am experiencing this show on more of like a visceral level, as if it weren't a Star Trek show and enjoying it that way. But kind of looking at it like, well, this isn't exactly what I was expecting from a Star Trek TV show. So this episode's getting a little closer.
Right. Yeah, I would agree that it does not have the feel of, you know, any of the other Star Trek series, where in terms of like these other Star Trek shows, you have like a well-oiled like team that is working together, whether it's the Enterprise or whether it's the crew of Deep Space Nine or Voyager or Enterprise. You have like, you know, six or seven protagonists that are working together at some common goal. Here, you know, Michael Burnham is your protagonist. We don't really know who else we can trust. We have a lot of people who are sort of like working against her interests. We have the captain who we don't really know what he's up to. So in that way, it is a lot different than any other Star Trek series.
Yes, it is. I'm curious to see where it goes. But this episode was particularly dark character wise. So you know, I figured I'd ask and see where you were coming down those lines.
Yeah. Well, I just think that's what this show might be. I think that in terms of the chronology of when these shows were produced, this is really the first show that has been created in sort of like this anti-hero era of television, sort of like, you know, post Breaking Bad, where all these different shows have these unsavory characters sort of like at the center of these different projects.
Yes. In fact, this show does go very Walking Dead when we get to the other ship that's been like mangled. So agreed.
And not just because Sasha is there.
Not just because Sasha's there. I think they were, I don't know what they were, you know. Do you know exactly what happened to that other ship? Were they like mid-warp?
No, let's talk about that. Yeah. So we go on the away mission, and we mentioned that Cadet Tilly ends up making the trip. Cadet Tilly also not great on a road trip, really talking everybody's ear off on the shuttlecraft.
Strangely annoying, right? She snores at night and talks all day. It's not the best combination on any sort of close you know, where you're close quarters.
Yeah. It's also not great when you have a roommate that's kind of annoying and then you spend the whole day with them also. Like, you need a break. You know, you are killing independent Michael Burnham when you have roommate Michael Burnham and then work Michael Burnham and then Cadet Tilly is there the whole time.
I actually thought Michael Burnham was going to become best friends with the Klingon on the ship when the Klingons shushed Tilly. She was probably very happy that somebody finally did so.
Yeah, somebody finally did that. You know, can I just also mention the line where we got to see in engineering when Michael Burnham was talking with Stamets, and they were talking about how he's like, I thought you were a Vulcan. And she's like, well, no. I'm not a Vulcan. I mean, he got a little like Brian Fellows with her. Like, it says here on my card that you are a Vulcan. She's like, no, that's not true. I was raised on Vulcan. He's like, well, my uncle is in a Beatles cover band, but that doesn't mean he's John Lennon. First off, they shoehorn so much 20th century yes. talk into the dialogue on this show. I think that if we polled 10 millennials, how many know who John Lennon is?
I say five. We should do this. We should actually poll 10 millennials and see how, you know, there's a whole tribe of them
and
out
there.
And
this is nothing against millennials. So I'm just like taking like one generation removed from people that were alive after John Lennon passed away. Okay. Now let's go like 15 generations later. How many people know John Lennon is one of the Fab Four in the Beatles?
We'll ask Adam Klein on a Thursday, Rob. I think we'll be able to figure this one. We'll get to the bottom
of
it.
Is this sacrilege, what I'm saying, to say that that the music of the Beatles will not be inherently well-known to generations of people 300 years from now?
I mean, I grew up in a Beatles family. I think it'll stand the test of time.
Sure.
But, you know, there's no books, so what do I know? I figured there'd still be books around.
Right, and, but and they will know the names of the Beatles. Like, I can understand, like, if there was, like, you know, like one
Mozart.
Or two iconic songs that sort of stand the test of time and are standards for years ago. But that people know there's Beatles cover bands.
Of course, it's like Edgar Allan Poe. Where like, it's he became a martyr, John Lennon. So you know, I think they probably worship them on some planets in the Star Trek universe.
Yes. Well, maybe Lieutenant Stamets served on the USS Ringo Starr. That was one of his the Ringo Star Trek.
Ringo Starr.
The USS Yellow Submarine.
Oh my god!
But okay. So, they go and they end up on board the ship. And we actually got to see Stamets talking to his friend that was working on the project.
That's his boyfriend, sort of, right?
I don't know if he was a romantic partner. He said best friend. I don't know. I don't want to assume that there was a romance there. I don't know if the show explicitly said that.
Fair enough.
And it's possible that was the case. And we got to see, you know, something has gone wrong. Do you get any sense of what happened to the sister ship of the Discovery, which was probably they needed to make it the sister ship of the Discovery just to save a lot of money on like the sets?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, they want to make it look exactly the same.
And to be fair, they would do that on like Star Trek: Next Generation. Also,
no,
that they were like,
sense.
"Oh, we're on one of the other, you know, eight galaxy class starships."
Exactly, they were all printed in the same place. I think what happened was, here's my guess. I think that they were like either experimenting with the spores and using it to like teleport around, or they were just like mid warp when. The Klingons came. They were all mangled, but the beast was also let loose there. That then,
where did
the
monster come
them.
From?
So I think the monster was an experiment on the sister ship because they're both these like weird science vessels that are under Lorca. So you would assume he's doing experiments on both ships. So I'm guessing that it's just the monster was on the ship. The ship got tied up mid warp. Everyone got mangled. The monster got out, and the
why didn't the ship get mangled?
I don't. The Klingons tried to intercept it mid warp. I don't know. That's a good question, Rob. But
there's a lot of things to unpack here.
Yes.
Why did the seemingly crew of the ship end up being like really distorted? Like it looked like the people like had their faces stretched like with silly putty
that
to the point they had like
out.
Bones stuck out of their back. And also like really gruesome deaths of all the different people. That's one. Two, what happened to the ship? Why does it have all these markings on it? Three, why are there Klingons on the ship, including a Klingon who was on the ship when they got there, but other Klingons are dead? And four, why is there a monster on the ship?
These are all, what do you think that Lorca planned all, did he orchestrate this as well?
No, I don't think he orchestrated this. This was beyond his orchestration.
So what's your theory on, I've already said my crazy theory. What's your theory on this one?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what exactly happened. I mean, they proposed on the show that the ship was sort of just like left for dead. And then there was a Klingon boarding party that came out. Now, maybe they let the monster out once the Klingons got on the ship as a way to sort of like protect them from the Klingons. I guess that's possible. What I was not buying was that the phaser fire was not working. They said set the phasers to kill, and then, like, if this was Star Trek The Next Generation, that thing would be vaporized. Like, I don't understand how it wasn't like it was one of the Borg where that monster had, like, some sort of shield frequency. If that's organic matter, the phaser should be able to vaporize it. Like, there is no, oh, phasers are not having an effect on this thing.
Well, it's an older model phaser, I guess.
But we saw the phaser melting metal.
Also true. Yes, it has to be, have a strong hide. I guess.
Get maybe, okay, oh, stun is not working. But when you put the phaser on its highest power, it's going to blow a hole in that thing. Like, maybe it's not going to vaporize it, but it is going to burn it.
That's why I think this was all orchestrated. I think that there was a plant. It was a phaser plant that was firing blanks because they wanted to keep their monster from getting killed.
So they put a maybe it's a monster who's sort of impervious to phaser fire. Is that where like they've changed the DNA of this thing?
He is some sort of weird mad scientist, the captain, possibly. But that does not explain. So Stamet, right? He's talking to his best friend. And that's, he died on the ship, right? There's not a whole lot of time in between.
Right.
When he got that call from his friend and when Captain Lorca came down and said, our sister ship is destroyed. Right. So how was this ship all of a sudden like lost in space for X amount of time where all this stuff went down?
I don't know. I don't know if there was maybe sort of like the interstellar travel ended up doing a number on the organic matter that was on board the ship where, you know, they, I guess maybe like the cracks or the markings in the ship, like that was sort of like the physical effects of this type of travel where maybe like their inertial dampening field cannot handle this type of speed at which you're going to travel through the universe. And then ultimately that's where we had the Klingons then come in when the ship was left for dead. And maybe they left this animal out. But to me, what's interesting about Captain Lorca, we mentioned the Tribble on his desk. It seems as though that he is into some sort of experimentation on animals. We saw like at the end of the episode that he had like various bones on his desk. And I'm not talking about Dr. McCoy. And so I think that he is some sort of like Dr. Moreau.
Yeah, he's got his own, he's on his own little island out there for sure. He reminds me a little bit of, like, this is the origin story for the Collector from Guardians of the Galaxy. He's just going to get kookier and kookier as things goes along. I'm just wondering, from tying this back to what we were talking about earlier, is Lorca, like, fighting for the good of Starfleet, or is he somehow the bad guy of this whole journey? Like, I'm just so confused after everything that happened in this episode. As fun as it all was, I just have no idea. Like, was that monster that he created, did he have that before, or did he just take it in now? Did he create that monster?
I don't know if he created it, but he beamed it aboard from the other ship.
Right. So we don't know that it was definitely his monster from the beginning. Maybe the whole thing was definitely the monster attacking.
But it seems like that he is fixated on it and is like that to me, which of course, like, you know, that thing is going to get out. But it seems like that he seems to know more about it. Like, maybe he knew that was on the ship.
Maybe the spores like open up some sort of black hole or something, and these are like creatures from that black hole. And so when they were experimenting
like
the
on mist?
Them, yeah, like the mist. Exactly.
Oh my God. Gorillas. It's terrifying.
Yes, I think that's what's going on here.
What do you think about Michael Burnham quoting Alice in Wonderland?
That drove me absolutely crazy. First of all, how many shows do we see people crawling through tight spaces quoting through the looking
it's
glass?
It's funny. Well, not the Alice in Wonderland, but I just did a podcast earlier tonight, and I was talking about Fear the Walking Dead, and I asked Jessica Lease about what is her threshold of the walking through the ventilation shaft trope.
This is it. Quoting Alice in Wonderland while doing it. I'm surprised they didn't just call the beast like the Jabberwocky or something. It was really Brian Fuller. This was the most Brian Fuller that Brian Fuller can do on a show like this.
Why do you say that?
You know, he's got his fascination with like whimsy and, you know, Alice in Wonderland is right down that.
Okay.
You know,
well, let me just say in defense of Star Trek Discovery. Yeah, I thought it was pretty hokey, but in doing some reading about the episode, apparently that it is canon that Spock has mentioned that his human mother would read that story to him, which I believe as Michael Burnham brings up later on in the episode, that woman is Amanda. I believe this is one and the same people, and yep. So that there is an established canon that Spock's mom would read Alice in Wonderland. So for that, I will give this a pass.
So basically, this is them saying, remember how Spock never ever said he had a sister of any sort,
right?
Ever, but she knows the same stories he knew, so clearly
that was a Starfleet mutineer, right?
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense then. I'm all is forgiven about the plot holes of all of that. I get it now.
Yeah,
they fixed it.
Okay. We didn't really talk too much about how Michael Burnham ended up taking the drool pillow of Cadet Tilly, and somehow for the first time in all of our time watching Federation starships, either in Enterprise, which is before this, or any of the Star Trek series which follow this in the timeline, some sort of breath operated door. This has never been seen before in any Star Trek movie or TV show. What did you think of this sudden invention?
You know, it's the next thing that iPhones are going to do. Instead of retinal scanners, it's going to be drool scanners.
Well, maybe like if you are somebody that needs like a breathalyzer to operate your car. But I mean, this seems
drug testing and identification at the same time.
Right. The least hygienic way to get anybody. I mean, right now, this seems less high tech than the iPhone X, which is just going to scan your face. Could you imagine if your iPhone was that you had to and like breathe on it and get like everybody's germs on it?
Instead of saying Alexa, you just spit on the device and it,
right.
And it orders something from Amazon.
She took like a drool pillow and then, what was that? Like some sort of like an air gun to make it simulate a breath. Like the Star Trek computers can get hacked that easily. It's like, okay, access unauthorized. Cadet Tilly is currently still sleeping.
Yes, it's an interesting. I mean, you would think that maybe
also,
this would be part
Cadet
of multiple.
Tilly does not have access to top secret spore area.
Also, Tilly was not snoring at the time, which she should have been doing based on her previous statements. Yeah, it's interesting.
She was
technology.
Sporing at the time.
Yeah, she was sporing at the time. Oh, geez. Yeah, I've been harvesting Jewel for a long time, and that is not the best way to do so. Other equipment, I think.
If anybody wants to hack into any of your secret areas with your breath scan, now they know the missing ingredient.
Last time I was at your office, Rob, I stole your jewel so I could get into the restricted areas.
Yeah. Well, good luck with that. Good luck with that. Yeah. Eventually, we're going to see Michael Burnham sort of like get... Captain Lorca's explanation on everything. He was mansplaining it all at that point.
about his lorchestrations. Yes, he gave it all away.
What was the room like? Okay, so they went down to engineering, and then was she like in the holodeck? I don't understand. Like, this was like the greatest PowerPoint presentation of all time that he was able to not just explain what he was talking about, but then he was able to sort of like really like demonstrate and transport her all over the place and lock her in this tiny room with the spores and give her like a light show also.
Yeah, it was really cool looking. I wish that I had a room like that where I could just kind of beam myself to random places that looked pretty. I thought that he was going to like lock her in the brig because she like turned him down. And yeah, that's where I thought it was going. But no, he had like a cone of silence that he could, put magical drug induced hallucinations into people's brains. I don't know. It's crazy. I still have no idea what these spores do. I know you think that it actually sends them to other places, but it seems to me like she just was glimpsed them.
Yeah. Well, how would that help prophecy. Them win the war against the Klingons? We're going
to they could like spy, you know, it's like it's a way to like spy on whatever you want to spy on at any given minute.
But you're not really there. You're just like seeing what's there.
Right. That's what I thought it was. I thought it was like, you know, this is our oracle. Now we're going to win. We can see everything they're doing in real time.
I don't know. I think you're literally going there.
God, that would be that wouldn't really. It makes so much less sense, though, if they're actually going there, like, 'cause she never like stopped down anywhere. So like, have they just not perfected it to where you can't actually stay? You just kind of hop.
Well, no, I don't think she actually was places. I think he was just like showing her like the brochure of like, we could be on Romulus. We could be on this planet. We could be on Andromeda.
No, because he put the spores in that room. I think he showed her exactly what the spores do. That's what I thought was happening. Like, he like injected the spores into the cube.
I think
and then
the spores were like showing her what like or like some sort of the hologram was showing her, but she didn't go anywhere. I mean, he didn't go anywhere. How did she still hear him?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I'm still very confused as to what these spores do. They're going to have to do a better job of explaining the spore situation.
Yes.
In STD.
Yes. Well, hopefully we'll be able to understand more of that as time goes along. But I think Michael Burnham, understands that Captain Lorca wants to take out the Klingons, and she might be being set up by Captain Lorca.
I don't know. Yes, I think that she thinks that is happening. I'm still not sure if that's the case. I think Lorca is looking for someone else who's a rule breaker because he views himself as a rule breaker. And I think he's going to put her as his number, as his number two. I think that she's about to become first officer on a ship of rule breakers.
Wow.
What's about to happen.
Wow. Yeah. I would say that Lieutenant Commander Saru seems like a mismatch with Captain Lorca.
They don't seem to be on the same page. How did Saru get onto that ship?
Because they liked how he did not want to engage the Klingons.
So that was also orchestrated?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't think it was orchestrated, but I think that he just got a promotion and this was a job that was open.
That seems very random. Of all the ships that he just happened to end up on that one.
Yes. I mean, that's a coincidence of that. We, all these characters we established in the premiere. Yes. Then,
I think Lorca's putting together a team of rivals. I think that's what he's doing.
I mean, in some of the reviews that I had read about this episode, people were questioning about why not start with this episode? Did we need the 2-hour premiere before we got to this episode where we were actually on board the Discovery?
To quote Josh Wiggler, nope, not at all. In no way did we need those.
Could we have seen parts of the first 2-hour premiere as flashback in terms of like, hey, you're Michael Burnham? And instead of then flashing back to Michael Burnham as a kid, could we have seen some flashback to what went on the Shangzhou?
Yeah, I think that's one way you could do it. You could just do the first two episodes as half an hour and have a 90-minute premiere. There's a lot of ways you could have fixed the pacing of how they rolled out these three episodes. That first episode would not entice anyone to sign up for All Access. I'm sure it enticed some people, but not as many as this episode would have. So I think they made a pretty big mistake there. I think they were also tied to whatever vision Brian Fuller had before he left, I think they probably wanted to be as faithful to that as possible. And I think that it seems as if there was a big shift in direction for the show after those first two episodes. So I think that that it may have been also out of, you know, showing respect to the work that Brian Fuller had done on creating the story.
Okay, John. So where do you feel like we go from here? The monster is going to get out.
Yeah. It becomes a monster movie for the next six episodes.
Yeah.
You know, I think that we're going to learn more about these spores. I think we're going to get more about the Klingon War and how they're augmenting the crew to be able to become a wartime vessel instead of a discovery vessel, right? Like, I think that's the main theme that's going on. And I think we're going to see Lorca kind of drive the Discovery down a path of like insanity. I think that he's really going to take them on a ride into his like crazy psyche. And I think that that's where this is going.
Yeah. I'm in. I really am enjoying Star Trek Discovery, and I can't wait to see where we go from there. I'm really liking life on board the Discovery more so than on board the two episodes that we saw on the Shangzhou. And so let's keep this going. I can't wait to see more of what the captain is orchestrating. And I think this is very fun.
I agree. I also can't wait for the show to kind of settle into what it is, right? Like, I feel like we just finally found out what the show is going to be, and I can't wait to like have some time on the bridge. We haven't, how long has it been with Star, like every Star Trek starts with introducing you to the bridge right away, and we still don't even know what this bridge really looks like. So I'm excited to like settle into, you know, Star Trek as an office drama.
Right. No, we have not gotten that. And maybe, you know, we don't even get that in his first season.
Possibly. I hope we get a little bit of it. At least we better spend some time on the bridge. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. All right. Well, great job, John. We have to go with the hashtag Lorcastrating.
Agreed.
Yes. Unless you want to go with Ringo Star Trek.
I like them both. I like them both. Lorcastrating, Ringo Star Trek. Can't lose.
Well, Lorcastrating is probably harder to spell, so let's go with Ringo Star Trek, just Ringo to, Star. Yes, I try to go to the lowest common spelling denominator when we do these things.
Probably smart. It's easier to get all of the stuff together into one, aggregate all of these hashtags that way.
I think that's the move. Of course, John, if people want to follow you and everything you're doing, what's the best way for people to do that?
You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at JohnReed16. There's no H in my name. And you can also head over to YouTube. We're the Nerdrotic channel over there. We're just covering all the geek stuff. So check that out. Subscribe if you get a chance.
Okay. John, thank you so much. This was very fun to go through everything.
Thanks for having me, Rob. It was really fun. It brightened up my day talking about Star Trek in this way. I was a little down, and now I've risen from that from the ashes.
From the ashes, yes. Like Michael Burnham. Okay.
Exactly.
We've got our recap of the latest Fear the Walking Dead here on Post Show Recaps. I'm also going to talk about the premiere of Curb Your Enthusiasm on Monday with Akiba Whitaker. And then Josh Wiggler and I will be back with our fourth episode of our Game of Thrones rewatch coming up as well. Make sure you don't miss any of it at postshowrecaps.com. And you can subscribe to our Star Trek only podcast feed at postshowrecaps.com/Star Trek. I should add also that Mike Bloom and Rich Tackenberg also have a recap of the season premiere of SNL up on postshowrecaps.com. So lots of great stuff for you to check out. Thanks so much, John. Thanks you guys for listening. We'll take care. Have a good one. Bye.